Hello. Welcome to New Books in Buddhist Studies, part of the New Books Network. I'm Luke Thompson, the host of the channel. Today I'll be speaking with Eric Braun about his new book, The Birth of Insight, Meditation, Modern Buddhism, and the Burmese Monk Ledi Sayadaw, published by the University of Chicago Press in 2013. This book examines the spread of Burmese Buddhist meditation practices during the 19th and 20th centuries and the social, political, and intellectual historical contexts that gave rise to this development. Braun accomplishes this by focusing on the role that the Burmese monk Ledi Sayadaw played in this movement. Central to the book is the importance of the Abhidhamma in Burmese Buddhist monasticism and, more specifically, the way in which Ledi Sayadaw spread the study of the Abhidhamma among the laity and used it as the foundation for insight meditation. In contrast to many recent proponents of insight meditation, who emphasize technique at the expense of study and theory, Ledi Sayadaw saw insight meditation and study of the Abhidhamma as an inseparable pair, with the latter serving as a basis for the former. Braun places Ledi Sayadaw's approach in the larger context of Buddhist and Burmese theories about meditation, exploring the different views on the relationships among concentration meditation, samatha, and stages of meditation absorption, jhanas, insight meditation as direct awareness of sensory and mental experience, and insight meditation as discursive thinking informed by Abhidhamic categories. Exploring the culture milieu of late 19th and early 20th century Burma, Braun demonstrates that Ledi Sayadaw exhibits characteristics that we would regard as traditional, as well as those we might think of as modern. In addition, as opposed to Buddhist reformers who argued that Buddhism was in fact applicable to and accorded with modernity, Ledi Sayadaw flipped this relationship on its head by asserting that modernity, for example Western science, was in agreement with Buddhism. In so doing, he avoided the usual contradictions between Buddhism and modernity, but without apparently compromising the Buddhist worldview in the process. Braun places Ledi Sayadaw's thoughts on these matters in the larger historical context of colonialism. Burma was annexed by the British in the 19th century, and many Burmese believed that Buddhism's final days were nigh. Ledi Sayadaw's theories, then, were in part a response to a new environment in which Buddhist monks were losing their traditional position as educators, and in which the age-old relationship between the Sangha and the state was abruptly terminated. Touching on doctrine, social trends, colonial history, meditation theories, notions of tradition and modernity, and Ledi Sayadaw's legacy in Burma and the West as it does, The Birth of Insight traces a complicated web of relationships. It ties 21st century American meditation centers to the place of 12th century Sri Lankan Abhidhamma exegesis in Burmese monastic curricula, the dismantling of the Burmese throne to Buddhist theories of declension and a proliferation of voices claiming to represent Buddhist orthodoxy, and British colonialism to Ledi Sayadaw's theories on the karmic relationship between individual and society. The book will be of particular interest to those working on Buddhist modernism, the relationship between religion and colonialism, the history of Burmese Buddhism, the Abhidhamma and Theravada Buddhism, the relationship between the Sangha and the laity, and Buddhist meditation in theory and practice. I hope you enjoy the interview. Hello, listeners, and welcome back to New Books in Buddhist Studies. I'm Luke Thompson, the host of the channel. Today I'm with Eric Braun, and we're going to be talking about his new book, The Birth of Insight, Meditation, Modern Buddhism, and the Burmese Monk Ledi Sayadaw, published by the University of Chicago Press in 2013 as part of its Buddhism and Modernity series. Eric Braun is Associate Professor of Religious Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Eric Braun, welcome to the show, and thank you for taking the time to speak with me today.
I'm very glad to be here. Thank you.
Now, I should mention for listeners that this book won the 2014 Toshihide Numata Book Prize in Buddhism, administered by the Center for Buddhist Studies at the University of California, Berkeley. And I understand that you were just out in Berkeley last month to accept your prize and give a talk on the book. So congratulations on that.
Oh, thank you very much. In fact, this year I was co-winner along with John Nelson, who wrote an excellent book on Japanese Buddhism called Experimental Buddhism. And it was a real pleasure to go out there and speak about my book and also hear about his work and just generally get to interact with folks. Very gratifying.
Mm. So I was wondering if you could begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourself, where you're from, how you came to the study of Buddhism and or Burma and or religion, any important influence in your life, for example, academic advisors who shaped you.
It's a great question, and always one that's can be a challenge to answer. When do you begin?
Sure.
For me, I had throughout my life up until my undergraduate studies, which were at the University of Georgia, I had gone to Catholic schools. In fact, my high school was an all-male Catholic military school run by Benedictine monks.
Wow.
And so you can imagine, and as was certainly the case, there was a sort of strong emphasis on religion, though it wasn't necessarily a extremely pious sort of atmosphere. It was always in the air, which doesn't necessarily make you inclined towards the study of religion. But for me, it seemed to always bring it to the fore and sort of have it in my consciousness. And even back then, and say in high school, not before that, really, for whatever reason, students often ask me why I'm interested in, sometimes I jokingly say, I don't know, maybe karma. But I don't know why, but in high school, I had developed a real interest in Buddhism, specifically, even back then. It sort of fell into abeyance or a kind of, a kind of stasis in college. And in college, I was an English major and didn't really study Buddhism at all, or religious studies for that matter. But then after college, I moved out to San Francisco and I began visiting the San Francisco Zen Center. My interest sort of rekindled. I began to study Sanskrit and some other languages like Avestan, ancient language related to Vedic Sanskrit in its oldest forms. And that sort of brought it back. And I ended up doing a great deal of study of languages, traveling in Asia, throughout much of Asia, in fact. And that sort of fixed it in my mind as what I wanted to do with my life. And so I stopped working for an investment bank and writing articles on how to invest your money for retirement and something totally unrelated to religious studies.
Ask you about that afterwards, but sorry, go on.
Oh, yeah. So if anyone is curious about how to prepare for retirement, let me know.
Yeah.
But valuable thing to do when you're 24 years old, in fact. But
yeah.
I did switch to a focus on Sanskrit literature, actually, generally, and I'm more than Buddhism, in fact, because I was originally interested in the contextual origins of Buddhism, and its interaction with Vedic culture, very late Vedic culture, and the Upanishads, Chandogya, and Brihadaranyaka, and these sort of things. But once I was at Harvard, which is where I ended up going for my PhD, I was tremendously influenced, well, by a number of folks, but I had two advisors, in fact. Initially, Stephanie Jameson, who's now at UCLA, who was tremendously influential on me in terms of the study of language, how to approach the text. And then subsequently, once Stephanie decided to go to UCLA, Janet Gyatso became my advisor and remains a tremendous influence on me and sort of guided me towards an inclination I already had towards the study of Buddhism in more contemporary manifestations. She had no agenda. She didn't necessarily want me to do that, but I sort of felt the possibility studying under her of exploring those interests, and I sort of took off, specifically focusing on Burma, because Burma is known as a place that they understand themselves, in fact, as a culture that really specializes, among other things, in meditation. And I was quite interested in meditation, and that sort of drew me there.
The actual sort of technical aspects of meditation, or more meditation as like as a cultural phenomenon, or sort of a as like a
in fact, both. That's a great question, because it does cover many different arenas, so to speak, and it was sort of the whole package for me that interested me. They do celebrate themselves in a sense, and I think justifiably so in many senses, as technical experts in what makes meditation tick, so to speak, and how, what are its inner workings, from the Theravada perspective, of course. But then at the same time, there's a tremendous just general popular interest in meditation. By no means does that mean that everyone meditates in Burma. I think scholars listening to this podcast would be well aware of that. But,
yeah.
Most Buddhists don't meditate, and that's true in Burma as well. But that said, relatively speaking, there is an astounding interest in actual practice, and even more broadly, even among those who don't practice, there's just a sort of general level of interest that's pretty intense. And so all those things sort of drew me there.
I see. So it was really the interest in Buddhist meditation, and then along with that, a developing interest in sort of more modern or contemporary Buddhism that led you to focus on Burma specifically.
That's right. I mean, I had always been deeply interested in the Pali text, and that was obviously an easy interest to keep as I began to study the Burmese Buddhist culture. But it is kind of interesting because I think often, quite understandably, and it's actually a very sensible thing, way to go, let's say, people are become deeply interested for both the heart and mind in a particular culture, in a particular Buddhist sort of tradition, and that draws them to then find a project that will work within that interest.
Right.
For me, it was, in fact, in some sense, the reverse. Mm-hmm. I already had a kind of interest in meditation and in Pali literature, and then I kind of came to Burma through that.
Right.
But you know, it served me well.
Yeah. Okay. So, well, thanks for that. So moving on to the book itself, in the introduction, you explicitly state that this is not a biography of Ledi Sayadaw, but rather an examination of the growth of meditation and development of modern Buddhism that is undertaken. And but you do this through using the life of Ledi Sayadaw as a sort of lens through which to view this, or more specifically, you look at Ledi Sayadaw's role in this growth and development. Right. And as such, you don't cover every single event in Ledi Sayadaw's life, but rather focus on those facets of his life that are directly relevant to the larger topics. That being said, could you begin us? Can you begin by just telling our listeners who Ledi Sayadaw was? I should just mention he was born in 1846 and died in 1923.
That's right. That's right. And you're quite right. I was keen to frame the book in a certain way so that a reader would not assume that I was going to give a kind of comprehensive view of his life. Mm-hmm. He had an incredibly rich and varied life. And so I do, in fact, give, I think, a pretty clear portrait of the sort of major milestones of his life in pretty much all arenas. Mm. But you're right. It is focusing, spending its time really specifically on his role in the emergence of mass meditation in Burma. But that said, I do kind of, the backbone of the book, or the spine of it, runs along the story of his life as well. So in the introduction, along with, you know, sort of clearing the way in terms of theoretical matters and certain definitional issues, I give the basic story of his birth and his early schooling up until the time he kind of takes off at the capital of Mandalay to begin serious study as a young, fully ordained monk, you know, around 20 years of age.
Mm.
And then the subsequent chapters sort of follow his life chronologically, even as they chart the sort of different facets of his contributions towards the emergence of mass meditation. Mm-hmm. And that was a bit of a trick, you know, in terms of the mechanics of how you create a book. How do you tell the story of his life chronologically to some degree to have that kind of interesting narrative propelling the reader forward at the same time that you deal with facets of his life that don't necessarily follow chronologically? Luckily, to a significant degree, it was pretty easy to jibe those two things. But it is true in terms of his life. He was a remarkable student in what was, when he was born and up through the first half of his life, really royal Burma, traditional Burma, ruled by a Burmese king. That's one of the things that makes his life so interesting, in fact, that his life really straddles this divide. Half of it is in the pre-colonial era, and then half in the colonial period. And his life can be read, in a sense, as a kind of formation in that pre-colonial period that then is applied to the problems of the colonial moment. And so when you look at his life, you see his birth, his traditional formation, his attendance at monasteries in the royal capital, well, his life mostly in one particular royal monastery called Danjiao, then his movement into the forest, the arrival of the British, and then a public career that sees him traveling all over the country of Burma. Now, by the way, as I think most people probably know, officially called Myanmar.
Yeah.
He travels all around. He becomes a public figure of tremendous notoriety and in many ways devotion. And then it, you know, sort of ends his career as this kind of famous monastic figure, famous for his learning, but also famous for his popularization of practice and his popularization of study among the laity.
Yeah. And of course, I should mention too that he wasn't born into it. It sounds like he comes from a very humble background.
That's true. Yes. I mean, he's from a family of traditional rice farmers in Upper Burma, about 60 miles, roughly, a town called Saint Pien, about roughly 60 miles from what was in the royal capital of Mandalay. And, you know, one interesting thing about that is the monkhood, as it does to a significant degree in many Theravada countries and elsewhere in the world today, represented a kind of means of mobility. You know, that it wasn't so incredibly unusual for a monk to come out of a small village and rise to prominence, because there were means, really a kind of meritocratic system where one could make one's way to prominence, even from fairly obscure beginnings.
Mm-hmm.
Though it's certainly true as well that prominent families, prominent people would certainly have a way, let's say a kind of ready means to become well known if they could also prove their abilities, say scholastically or
right.
in some other way. But yeah, it certainly was a means for him. Though I should say that it seems quite clear from his biographies and everything we know about him that this was not someone who had chosen the monastic life because it was the only means for him to kind of get out into the
right.
world.
Right.
He seems to have been quite devoted to his identity as a monk and his practice as a monk.
So that leads us. Thanks for that sketch, and that leads us into the first chapter, which, you give a synopsis of Ledi Sayadaw's early years after he left his village right. and headed to Mandalay, the royal capital, to gain entrance into what was perhaps the most important monastery in Burma at the time. So he arrives in Mandalay in 1869 at the age of 22 or 23, and he stays for, I think it's about 14 years, till 1883, when the monastery burned down. So could you please, and also I should mention just the important sort of colonial dates, which was 1852, the British annexed Lower Burma, and then 1886, shortly after he left Mandalay, they annexed Upper Burma. But could you please describe the type of environment that Ledi Sayadaw found himself in the monastery in Mandalay? For example, what was emphasized in the curriculum, and what was the relationship between this specific monastery in the state and also just between, elite monasteries in the state more generally?
Sure. Well, in many ways, that chapter is entitled The Best of Times and the Worst, because I start that chapter by noting that in many ways, traditional Buddhist learning was at its apex.
Mm-hmm.
Under King Mindon, who ruled from 1853 to 1878, there was tremendous, almost unprecedented in terms of its intensity, patronage of Buddhism.
Mm-hmm. Sort
of kings defined themselves by their patronage of Buddhism, so he was not alone at all in that role. But he really took it to an astounding level. And so royally sponsored monasteries, many of them ringing the royal complex, which is surrounded by a moat in the center of Mandalay, these received a great deal of support, patronage, what have you. So when you went there, if you made your way into one, you were really kind of close to the center of power, not only sort of literally, geographically, but figuratively too, in the sense that there was a great deal of attention being paid to you from the center of political power there in the capital. This meant that the traditional role of a monk in this environment was one of learning.
Mm-hmm.
Meditation was something that, certainly, I mean, in some ways we can't know exactly what went on in, say, the privacy of a monk's room, but
mm-hmm.
it was not, there wasn't prominence put on meditation as such, as a practice, let's say, in the capital. The way a monk made his name, the way he sort of made his reputation and rose to prominence was on the basis of his scholastic abilities.
I see.
Certainly at this time, in the sort of late royal period of Upper Burma that remained free, as you noted, in 1852, the British had taken over the whole of the bottom half of the country. They'd actually taken the sort of tail of Burma, sort of Isthmus of Kra area, up to around Molamyine, a little above, in 1824, and then in 1852, the rest of the lower part. So given this, the free folks, so to speak, in Upper Burma were very aware of the presence of the British, and their behavior was certainly attuned to the reality of the British just below them, that they
mm-hmm.
felt extremely threatened by, and justifiably so, as was proved, some decades later,
mm-hmm.
when they did take over the whole thing. What this means is that although in many senses it was a traditional environment in which learning was celebrated, and it was quite traditional learning, particularly study of the Abhidhamma, the philosophical, let's say abstract theoretical texts that put the Dharma teachings into their most, let's say, purely ultimate form, as they would say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, study of that most rarefied and typically considered most difficult section of the canon was, that was the way to truly make yourself a prominent figure, and Leti excelled at that.
Mm.
That's going on. But at the same time, because of the awareness of the British just below, there's also great attempts to respond to the kind of pressures and the realities of that by modernization.
Mm-hmm.
And while that didn't mean explicit policies necessary to make the monks act in some way more modern, it certainly wasn't something lost on the monks who were near the apex of power.
Mm-hmm.
And so Leti as a figure could see that. And this seems to have promoted at least the intellectual interest in meditation,
yeah,
along with a use of learning as a means to respond to the challenges of the British.
Sure.
So Leti was getting a real mix, in other words, where he was sort of celebrated for traditional learning and his in excelling in that.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, he clearly sees the need to respond to the challenges of the modern world. He sees court figures doing it, and even he participates to some degree in ways they respond to that, to those challenges. I don't want to go on too long, so maybe I'll stop there. But
sure, no.
If you're curious for more detail, I can certainly.
Yeah, no. Well, some of those things you get into, we'll talk about in more detail when we look at later parts of the book.
Right.
I also wanted you to, I was also wondering if you could discuss the role of the layman. Is it? I'm going to mispronounce his name, but Po Liang, or a minister about 16 years,
yeah,
Leti's elder. Because the monastic environment that you just described for us, that was one big influence on Leti's formative years in Mandalay, or after he arrived in the capital of Mandalay. But what was the influence of this minister on Leti's sort of, on his worldview, and specifically on his view of sort of Western influences?
Right. He's in fact who I was thinking of when I was thinking of examples that could be given of ways they were responding that Leti was involved in.
Mm-hmm.
His name is pronounced some Upohlein. And he, as you say, he was a court minister who was sort of put in charge by Mindon. He was quite close to Mindon of among other figures, in fact. But
Mindon being the king.
I'm sorry, say it again.
Mindon being the king.
Yes, I'm sorry. Yeah. Mindon being the king. Po Liang had this job, along with others, of interacting with the West, of making sense out of Western learning. And Po Liang was also known to be extremely learned and very well versed in Buddhist texts, including the Abhidhamma. Leti, it seems, under his own initiative, decided to create and cultivate a relationship with Po Liang, and eventually does kind of come under his wing.
Mm-hmm.
So he'll subsequently say, the way I write is thanks to Po Liang. And there does seem to be a great influence on his literary style and I think also on his knowledge of the Western world. So Po Liang explicitly tried to jibe, so to speak, to bring together Western learning with Buddhist learning. And so, for instance, wrote several texts about meditation that sought to make meditation sensible in the modern world, we might say.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, one text in particular, this text called The Meditation on the Body, sought to align an Italian anatomy textbook with Buddhist Abhidhamma thought.
Mm.
So, in a sense, they're made to be, to some degree, equivalent to one another in terms of their kind of access to the natural world. But then, of course, in the end, the Abhidhamic perspective is sort of celebrated as the ultimate one because it's the one that leads to awakening and freedom.
I see.
So in a way, Western learning comes to be through works like that by Po Liang, subsumed into the Buddhist worldview. And this was an example I think Leti was profoundly influenced by when he would then subsequent to this, you know, some decades later, in fact, in many of his works, sort of incorporate Western knowledge in a fairly glancing way. He wouldn't spend a lot of time doing it, but he would take Western knowledge, or he'd use an example from Western culture or technology, and he would use it in the service of proving a Buddhist truth, or showing the kind of comprehensive perspective of Buddhist teachings in relationship to this stuff from the West. So Po Liang was tremendously influential in this regard, since he sort of served as the model for how to do this that Leti could see through his close interaction with him.
Another thing that you cover in this section is Leti Sayadaw's Letter on Cows. Could you just say quickly what the letter on cows was, and more importantly, how it reflected Leti's view of karma and the relationship between the individual and the sort of larger society? And sort of society as a whole, because this seems to be a theme that this relationship, his views of karma and this his ideas about this relationship between the individual and the community seem to be a theme that run throughout his writings.
Right, yes. Well, Leti, you know, in some degree, this harks back to what we were talking about a little while ago when we were talking about the way this book approaches Leti's life. I try to touch upon all the major aspects, but really focus on the meditation. But so I mentioned this in the book, and in this instance, in talking about this letter, I developed it distinctly. But there was a very large component of Leti's life that involved his attempt to kind of morally reform the Burmese people. Mm-hmm. And around this, he wrote a number of what are sometimes called metasadis, kind of loving letters or letters of admonition on all sorts of matters of moral reform that he was interested in getting lay people behind. Mm-hmm. Not drinking, not gambling, not using other kinds of intoxicants, and not eating meat, particularly beef. Mm-hmm. So by no means was this the only letter, for instance, on not eating beef. But this letter on cows that comes to be published later, but was first actually sort of circulated before print had really arrived in the country. Mm-hmm. It really encouraged I think the word is appropriate, admonished lay people not to partake of animal meat at all if they could help it, but at least of beef, particularly because of a relationship of gratitude towards animals for what they provide through their plowing of the fields and their kind of work with the farmer. Mm-hmm. So there was an idea behind this karmically, that there's this kind of karmic bond, so to speak, between these farm animals, these laboring animals and people that needs to be respected, that mm-hmm. And that to eat them, to kill them and eat them after they've labored to feed the Burmese people through these agricultural activities that produce plants, of course, was just a really gross injustice in a sense, and terrible karma. And he extrapolates not just from those who particularly want to eat meat, or those who say particularly kill the animal, which mm-hmm. is often a justification even now that gets used for why you can't eat meat because you're not the one who killed it. Mm-hmm. You know, people are often ready to say, well, you're creating the market for it if you buy it. Well, even back then, Leti was making that same argument in his letter, for instance. And his argument was that in the end, what happens from the kind of sum total of these individual behaviors of killing animals and buying the meat and eating it is a kind of socio-karmic effect. Mm. And so there's a kind of cultural karma or a communal karma, let's say, that affects the Burmese people as a whole because of this kind of general corporate bad behavior. Mm-hmm. And so he notes that I have it in the book there. There's a moment in the letter where he says, well, if you're asking why, you know, all these bad things are happening, I'm paraphrasing here, of course, mm-hmm. if you're asking why all these bad things are happening and we're, you know, we've lost control of the country and whatnot, you know, don't blame other people, blame yourselves, mm-hmm. because it's because of the way in which we're not following the moral law that would ensure our sort of health and wealth, namely the kind of law of karma that needs to be followed. So moral renovation on the individual level becomes also a kind of it's only a sort of proto form here, but a kind of almost nationalistic endeavor. Mm-hmm, because mm-hmm. the more individually moral a person is, the more they're sort of adding to the karmic health of the country or the society as a whole. Mm-hmm. For Leti, I should say that Leti wasn't necessarily thinking in terms of the nation state. They didn't have those sort of, that would be kind of anachronistic mm-hmm. from Leti's perspective, at least initially. But he certainly was thinking of the kind of communal Burmese people and their sort of karmic health. And so all these kind of moral efforts are actually in line with the propulsion towards meditation that he and study as well that he encourages, in that they all sort of add to the karmic health of the country, mm-hmm. And therefore could be kind of nationalistic contributions towards ultimately Burma's freedom.
Mm-hmm. So it seems like he's quite different then from the Young Buddhist Men's Association, for example, which focused far more on trying to implement policy changes. It's almost as if he's putting the responsibility on the Burmese rather than the British when looking at the British takeover of Burma, for example.
Yes, that's right. I mean, in a way, I don't think he had any problem. He doesn't really speak about it, but I don't think he had any issues with the idea of passing laws that
right.
were forbidden, say, meat eating. But alcohol had been forbidden under Mindon, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it was the case that he felt like that was pointless or a
right.
bad idea. But you're right. He put the focus squarely on, I think, where he felt the heart of the matter was,
yeah.
which is the kind of moral quality of the individual.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So getting to the end of the chapter, you discuss Letty's departure from Mandalay in 883, I believe, and his first serious foray into meditation. Now, I'm going to ask you to discuss Letty's sort of his own ideas about meditation later on in the interview. But for now, I just wanted to ask you to... talk about the sort of intellectual historical and political context in which meditation became increasingly important, because as you mentioned in the book, it wasn't only Letty who was beginning to focus increasingly upon meditation.
That's right. Yeah. At the time when Letty was living in this monastery called Thanjaung, just sort of bordering the royal complex, he certainly would know about this nascent movement towards meditation that was taking place just a handful of miles away in the hills of Sagaing, this
mm-hmm.
this town, you know, very near, just across the Ayawadi River from Mandalay, very, very close by.
Mm-hmm.
He would have known about this and certainly would have seen that meditation was being, through the writings of Upothan and these other people, it was being developed as an intellectual project. It was receiving much patronage in that regard. It always, I should say, had been an intellectual project, but it kind of was taking on a new sort of emphasis at the court at this time intellectually.
Mm-hmm.
But also being these monks who were beginning to meditate in the hills of Sagaing were being patronized as well. Then at the same time that he sees this sort of response to the scene, to the, let's say, the what's going on at the time just in Upper Burma, he also sees the subsequent destabilization of the country.
Mm.
You know, Mindon's reign ended in 1878, and his son Thibaw took over in a very bloody sort of secession. And during Thibaw's fairly short reign, because 1878 to 1885, not really that long,
right.
the country became more and more unstable. That eventually led to all sorts of social unrest, including a very large fire that burnt down his monastery along with a large portion of Mandalay in 1883. And that's really the kind of direct prompt to Letty's departure for the forest,
mm-hmm.
so to speak. All the unrest, which they would have been well aware was sort of being fomented or catalyzed, let's say, by the relationship with the British to the south. It led Letty to the loss of his home, to the loss actually of all the kind of intellectual work he'd been doing. It said he lost the multiple manuscripts of notes he had to a book he was writing at the time.
Mm.
I think this gave him a very powerful sense. In fact, you can see it in a poem he wrote around this time where he talks about it being near the end of the sasana, near the end of the era of Buddhism. Perhaps somewhat hyperbolically, but, you know, this kind of sense that things are ending.
Mm-hmm.
This seems to have propelled him to take this step, as he had seen some monks doing and some intellectual work being done on, this step towards meditation.
Mm-hmm.
So in 1883, he goes back to his hometown. He actually lives there for a while in a monastery before he actually enters into the jungle. But then he does explicitly enter into the forest to begin the explicit practice of meditation. And this is when it really starts for him, it seems.
Mm-hmm.
It does seem to be a combination of the kind of observation of the instability of the world, the sense that things are coming to an end, potentially Buddhism itself coming to an end, and a kind of the kind of model of other people already meditating. He sort of brings this together to take on the meditation himself.
I see. So just to clarify, when he moves into the forest, he's moving to a monastery that's been sort of built for him. He's not a wandering forest monk.
Not much. You know, the story is told that he actually goes into the forest with with some lay people, and finds the foot of a tree and says, "I'm going to stay here." Mm-hmm. So it sounds like he really is going to be pretty much homeless, but in very, very short order. And, you know, he had brought these lay people along with him, so I don't think he was envisioning that he was going to be cutting all ties with, say, his devotees and his lay patrons and whatnot. In quick order, he gets a monastery built and begins to teach and study once again, even as he combines it with meditation. Mm-hmm. In fact, this is a very good point, because I stress this in the book, that unlike, say, the wandering forest monks we see in the Thai forest tradition, mm-hmm. or in some other traditions, this was Leydi's interest was not to forego intellectual study, for instance, in favor of practice, mm-hmm. or to take on an utterly homeless life of peripatetic wandering or whatnot. And in many ways, in the sense, he was only going to add meditation to what he was already doing. Mm-hmm. But now in this kind of more charged setting of the forest, which of course has deep resonances in Buddhist traditions for being, you know, the place of serious work and serious meditative activity and whatnot.
Okay, so So moving on a bit, in your second chapter, you focus on a controversy that erupted around a work that Leydi published in 1901 called the Paramattha Dīpani. And this is a commentary on the Abhidhammasangaha, an extremely influential and concise presentation of the Abhidhamma teachings that was written in Sri Lanka sometime between the 10th and the 12th centuries. And I think it was most recently translated in English by R.P. Vijayaratne and Rupert Gethin. But the question you raise here, and the question that I certainly had, is why did anyone besides a small number of scholastic monks even care about a highly technical commentary written in Pali, not in Burmese, that focuses on a work from 700 to 900 years prior? Now, to answer this question, you address a number of factors, including the rise of popular print culture in Upper Burma in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, Burmese attitudes towards the Abhidhamma from the 7th century on, which is also a very important point in this book, and also the esteem attached to textual learning in Burmese Buddhism, monastic culture more generally. So I was wondering if you could just talk about why this work did create such a controversy, and also about some of those factors, for example, the historical importance or the perceived importance among Burmese of the Abhidhamma.
Sure. Yeah. I mean,
you already addressed that a little bit earlier, but.
Right. Right. Well, you're certainly hitting the thrust of that chapter right on the head there with that question of then why would they care so much? Why would there be controversy around this so much? In some ways, it becomes quite clear simply from the fact that the Abhidhammasangaha, that text, that 12th century roughly Sri Lankan text, although it is from Sri Lanka in Pali from centuries before this moment in Burmese history, it had remained and it remains up to the present day without question a tremendously important text to the formation of I guess you'd say monastic sensibility and identity, mm-hmm. but certainly in terms of monastic educational formation. It is the text, say, that monks, when they're quite early in their career, say, not even fully ordained, say they're in their teens, this is the text you memorize first as your kind of gateway into your the study of the Abhidhamma. Mm-hmm. So it's a foundational work to Abhidhamma study, and of course, as I said earlier, Abhidhamma study understood to be the kind of crowning achievement of the Buddhist literature as the most important, then this text becomes all the more important as the entry into that, which is the most prestigious section of the canon that there is. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, the Burmese respect and revere all aspects of the canon, mm-hmm. but the Abhidhamma is understood to be sort of the kind of primus inter pares or whatever, you know, sort of the sort of the number one among equals, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So if you attack, if in some sense you're perceived as attacking that text, mm-hmm. then among some people Leydi was perceived as doing, mm-hmm. then of course you generate a lot of ire, because not only is the text just flat out revered and respected and used so widely, mm-hmm. in Burmese Buddhism at his time and even up to the present day, but many monks' authority is going to be based upon their understanding of that text.
I see.
And if their understanding is criticized as faulty, well, you can see the kind of reaction this might produce. Now, I don't want to get too deep into the weeds here, but the way into that, you know, with this Abhidhamma matters, but the way into that text, which is a kind of, it's not so much a commentary, it's not a commentary, it's a compendium, it's a kind of distillation of the, of all the books of the Abhidhamma, and to a significant degree, even some of the teachings of the suttas, In printed version, it can be about 50 pages. So it's really a quite tight little work. So really handy in that regard. But it's so concise that if you want to make sense out of it, you do need a commentary, a kind of explanation of it. And there's one in particular called the Abhidhammata Vibhavini, which is is translated by Gethin and Vijayaratne. That is also absolutely foundational to kind of the Burmese sense of their understanding of the Abhidhammata Sangaha. And because of that, they were not wrong in saying that Leddy was attacking that text, which he was. So Leddy didn't actually attack the Abhidhammata Sangaha, not at all.
Right.
But he attacked the commentary on it extensively, and that commentary is sort of the key for most, at the time and even up to the present day, in fact, that text is the sort of key to understanding, sort of opening the door into the Abhidhamma. And so if you attack that, you're really attacking people's kind of sense of themselves and their kind of identity and their prestige and whatnot. And it produced just a giant reaction. As I say in the chapter, his criticisms are not of great substance.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't, you know, they're really pretty small. But nonetheless, even if he didn't produce a lot of heat, he produced a tremendous amount of light, so to speak, through this controversy. And it was tremendously important socioculturally, I guess we'd say, for Leddy, I think. I argue this in the book, because the intensity of the reaction, which was most definitely supported by the arrival of print culture, I think taught Leddy a lesson that lay people who became very involved in the controversy in a kind of unprecedented way at this moment, it really taught Leddy that the lay people were interested in the Abhidhamma, were keen to learn it, were able to really master some of its ideas, and that sort of propelled him to begin to teach it to lay people, in fact, even beyond this controversy, once the controversy had sort of died down. Now, I haven't gotten into everything I think you asked in that question. It's a very rich question, but you know, that kind of gives you a sense of where the controversy was at.
Sure, sure. So just to clarify, I mean, people were involved in this controversy, even though they may not have been. People could sort of participate, even from the sidelines, in this controversy, even if they didn't necessarily have the scholastic learning to understand the specific arguments or refutations being made.
Yeah, so maybe, you know, there'd be a spectrum of how much people would engage with the nitty-gritty, say, of the technical aspects of, like, what the arguments actually were. And so you see a wide range of kind of styles of response. Some are very ad hominem. You know, I mentioned in the chapter that one person basically called Leddy names in print, and one of Leddy's disciples actually gathered up all the books he could get a hold of by this guy and burnt them. And there was the urging of a number of other book burnings of ladies' books. These don't seem to have really happened. That one instance seems to be kind of, well, it seems to be, there could have been others, but that's the really well-known one. But many people, for instance, lay people could read, they would, it was, this controversy was discussed extensively in the newspapers of the time. And so people could get a kind of précis, so to speak, a kind of just general overview of what's going on.
Right.
And then there was many public meetings held, and people could kind of, they could have dialogues about what is being said and what's going on there, and sort of establish, you know, or appoint someone to be their specific responder. So in many different ways, in these different kind of aspects, people could take part in the controversy.
Right.
Certainly tons of books, many books, were published in response to Leddy's critique. And so there were many different things you could read to take part.
So I should mention for listeners that you go into great specificity with regards to, you know, some actual examples from Leddy's work in this chapter, but We won't get into the sort of detail right here.
right.
So in chapter three, you're looking at some of the ways in which Leddy attempted to counter what he viewed as the negative effects of the British colonial governance of Burma and the presence of Christian missionaries. Now, you've already talked a bit about some of Leddy's views of the cause of the deterioration of Buddhism in Burma and how he tended to look more to individual conduct as the solution rather than sort of larger policy changes. Now, you've also addressed the importance of Abhidhamma Burma more generally, but why was Abhidhamma so important in Leddy's fight against colonialism and in preserving adherence to Buddhist belief and practice?
Well, there's a number of reasons, fairly overdetermined. One aspect that I don't think I really touched on extensively, but certainly comes out in some of the earlier chapters as well, is that as the quintessence, so to speak, of Buddhist teachings, the Abhidhamma is also the most fragile. Mm-hmm. So as in all forms of Buddhism, in the Theravada, Buddhism is something that's understood to itself be subject to impermanence in terms of its knowledge of it in the world. Of course, mm-hmm. the Dharma is just the way the world is at all times. But typically, it's understood classically as the dispensation of the Buddhist teachings can last 5,000 years, mm-hmm. but might not necessarily last that long if people act badly. Mm-hmm. Or are immoral, who eat beef, who take intoxicants, who gamble, whatever. So one reason to focus on the Abhidhamma is that it is the sort of frontline defense against the degeneration of Buddhism and of the Buddhist tradition, because in this 5,000 year span of time, it has been stipulated, it is in the commentaries by Buddhaghosa and other authors, that the disappearance of the Buddha of Buddhism will happen in stages. Mm. And in terms of the texts, the first thing to go will be the Abhidhamma, because it is the most rarefied and sort of precious of the teachings, the most abstruse. And of those teachings, the most, that is to say the Abhidhamma, the most rarefied and abstruse is the Patana, the conditional relations that forms the seventh book of the Abhidhamma. Mm-hmm. So that will be the first book to go. Mm. So the Abhidhamma as a whole is the first thing to go, and even within it, there's a specific book. This would lead to a sense then that if you can protect the Abhidhamma, you can protect Buddhism as a whole, because it is the sort of first thing to go. If you can hold onto that, you've held onto the whole thing, so to speak. And so that leads towards a tendency to encourage study of the Abhidhamma. Not even necessarily, though that this was certainly encouraged for intellectual understanding, but simply because if you have it in your mind, mm-hmm. you're preserving it, and you're mm-hmm. protecting it, and you're thereby keeping Buddhism around, so to speak, to a significant degree. Correlative with this, though, is the sense certainly that because these are the most precious and rarefied teachings, they're also the ones that give the most accurate description of the nature of reality, and therefore, if mastered, are most conducive towards a kind of liberative understanding of the nature of the world. And so in a culture which has celebrated the Abhidhamma and done extensive work learning and teaching and understanding the world through Abhidhamma modes of analysis, already exemplified way back by Upo Lein in Leddy's life, mm-hmm. then to not only encourage people to preserve Buddhism by learning it, but it would make sense too, and it's like Leddy, to encourage people to use that learning as the means to analyze reality, because it was the most conducive towards awakening. Mm-hmm. In whatever stage a person could reach. And so for these general reasons, I'm not sure if this covers your question entirely. Those would be reasons he certainly would celebrate Abhidhamma, and he did.
Yeah. No, that does. One other thing I wanted to mention is that you also discussed the way in which Leddy's preaching differed from previous styles. And I wanted to ask how innovative this was on his part, or was he part of a larger trend? You didn't explicitly say this, but my impression was it sounded like there was a shift from emotional engagement with a sermon born of the idea that one is accumulating merit simply by hearing a sort of, a monotonous sermon in Pali that one might not be able to understand. The difference between that type of emotional engagement and the type of emotional engagement resulting from a more passionate and lively performance on the part of the preacher.
I think that's true in a way. I think one would want to be careful that I suspect, because of course this kind of preaching still certainly takes place, though you know, it's changed somewhat. That if it was, say, one of these kind of traditional, what they used to call the fan-up sermons at this time, which meant that the monk held the fan in front of their face to block a view of their face.
Right.
You know, that sort of preaching, which might be, if not in Pali anyway, was replete with Pali, long Pali quotations and sort of references and whatnot. I think there was profound, I think you see this actually in many different Theravada cultures, profound sort of devotional engagement with that. Mm-hmm. But as you're quite right, it's a very different sort of emotional engagement. So in other words, what I'm trying to say is I don't know that people would find it necessarily monotonous in the sense that they found it boring or just sort of dry, or they just sort of had to sit through it to get the karma. They might be really into it. And I don't mean to suggest that you were necessarily saying it was like that, but I just want to make sure people don't think that it wasn't probably a very affective experience for people with the so-called fan-up style.
Right.
But it's true that once that fan was put down, and that's what these new monks were called, monks of the fan-down style, and Leti was most definitely among them and was one of the earliest, though by no means was he the first full stop. Mm-hmm. He was sort of partaking in a brand new trend that sought a different kind of emotional connection to the audience in which they could see your face, you're talking directly to them, Well, you see this often now, even in modern Burmese preaching. The monk will engage in this really kind of lively call and response, where they'll say something and the entire audience booms back, "Yes, Pia," or "Yes, monk," and they're responding and they're going back and forth. And it's said that he was really funny. He's cracking jokes. He's making little pithy poems in Burmese for them to memorize, so that they make sure they learn the thing. So what this all tends towards is actually an emphasis as well on a kind of intellectual understanding. And it's said that I quote this in the book, that he gave the Abhidhamma like falling rain. That had never really been preached on in a kind of productive way before, in the sense that that preaching was done to try to teach lay people Abhidhamma. Uh-huh. That was really quite distinctive of Leti, that he spoke in normal, fairly simple Burmese to try to get people to actually gain some content in Abhidhamma. Uh-huh. And that was really quite unusual.
I see, yeah. That's interesting. I don't know if this is correct. I always imagine it's the difference between listening to like Gregorian chanting in Latin in a cathedral and maybe, you know, hearing a sort of Southern Baptist preacher, speak the word or something, where, you know, one's an engagement with a certain like ritual space or experience, and maybe one's a bit more engagement with a particular person. I don't know. But
I see what you mean. Yeah, there is a much more of a populist bent to it, though. It would almost be like Leti were translating Gregorian chant into more normal words and then telling them what the Gregorian chant meant. Mm. That would be in some ways. But you're quite right. Yeah, it's much more of a kind of engagement with the audience.
So in chapter four, you focus on a work by Leti called The Summary of the Ultimates, written in 1903 and first printed the following year. Now, this is, in fact, a poem. And this was, correct me if I'm wrong, but this might have actually been its most influential work. Could you briefly describe the work and what it's, and more so than its content, maybe, can you describe what it's supposed to do or convey?
Sure. Right. Well, it's a poem of roughly like around 600 verses in Burmese, quite simple Burmese in the sense of grammatic structure of the poem itself. It's meant to actually just give you full on a kind of translation of the Abhidhammata Sangaha, that 12th century Sri Lankan Pali text that we were talking about before, that was the focus of the second chapter on that controversy. So it's just meant to basically be a Burmese version of that. It turns out it's not, but that's what Leti explicitly says it is.
Right.
It's just a translation from Pali into Burmese so that normal folk can memorize it and understand it.
So, and you say that this summary, this work, this poem of 690 verses, reorients the Abhidhamma to lay concerns, and more specifically, that it helps the lay person understand his or her role within the cosmos, and thus how to act within this life, within the cosmos. So how does it achieve this, and how does it make the Abhidhamma any more relevant to the laity?
Well, it does it in a number of ways. It, in subtle ways, it shifts. I sort of engage this through fairly close textual analysis.
Mm-hmm.
It shifts the emphasis onto what might be the kind of metaphysical, let's say, concerns of lay people. It's not that the poem says, oh, you know, when you're having a fight with your spouse or when your kids won't listen to you. It's nothing like that, where it gets quite that folksy or specific to people's lives. But for instance, there's a moment in the cosmology where if you compare them, because the Abhidhammasangha does give you a extremely brief, just kind of quick rundown of cosmology, the different levels of existence. Well, it's really, it amounts to just like like four stanzas that basically break down the world into these different levels, right? Well, in ladies, it gets expanded to many different levels with actual measurements of the distance between the different worlds. Because one argument I make is because for lay people, you know, the understanding themselves within this kind of cosmological framework, this Buddhist cosmological view, that was tremendously important to their understanding of their lives, because much was oriented around an economy of merit in which you were aiming towards, you know, affecting your movement in that cosmos, hopefully up and not down, right, towards the hells.
Right.
And then I note an interesting shift that takes place, that in the Abhidhammasangha, very basic rundown of this cosmos, the human realm is just mentioned where it falls, you know, basically on a kind of razor's edge between heaven and hell. You know, you've got the heavens, you've got human, you know, animals and whatnot, and then you enter into the hells. But Lady reorients it so that the human realm is actually mentioned last, as in some sense, almost a culmination of the cosmological scheme. Not because he's saying it's best to be human of any other thing in any kind of grand, total or complete sense, definitely not. It's all part of samsara and whatnot. But what he's doing is he's drawing attention for the reader to their place as a human, as a kind of draw attention back to them by ending the verses on the cosmos with them. And so this is one way he does it. At the same time, he writes an auto commentary that goes along with this poem that specifically addresses morality and practice and whatnot in terms that include lay people. So the Abhidhammasangha tended to define, say, well, there's a moment where it talks about the requisites of a monk, and, you know, the necessities of a monk to live a life as a monk, you know, the robes and the bowl and whatnot, the razor and water strainer and whatnot. And it makes no mention of lay life. Lady, on the other hand, reorients that and discusses life in general, both for lay people and for monks, as a way to kind of include them, so to speak, in the concerns of the text. There's many instances of this kind of like subtle shift. And then I might just say that, as I noted, it's a quite simple text. And so it was easy for people to memorize and learn and kind of incorporate and recite. And so to that degree, it made itself much more approachable, I guess you'd say, and sort of feasible to study for lay people.
Sure. So you're now the penultimate chapter, or the chapter before the conclusion, is where you sort of address Leti's efforts to promote meditation and his views of meditation more fully. And you begin by noting that Burma witnessed the spread of Buddhist study and meditation practice among the laity far earlier than other parts of Southeast Asia or Sri Lanka. And you also point out that Leti's emphasis on meditation was in line with his belief that the way to save Buddhism was through individual cultivation. One of the primary themes in this chapter, indeed in Leti's thought as you present it, is the relationship between study and practice. So I guess more specifically, you're here, the study of the Abhidhamma, the sort of Buddhist metaphysics, and meditation. So what is the relationship between study or knowledge on the one hand, and then meditation on the other? And how did he, through his social organizing, how did he promote this among the laity?
Right. Well, you know, I think, of course, Lady maintains this sort of triumvirate of Pariyatti, Patipatti, and Pativeda, so study of the text, practice, and then realization, respectively. It's certainly not that he breaks those down, but I think there was a much greater tendency than, say, you see here in the States, to see study as a kind of natural starting point for self-cultivation that mm-hmm. would lead naturally to that would segue right into practice. Mm-hmm. And so there wasn't such a sharp division between the two. And so in many ways, like Lady remarks, in fact, at the end of that that poem we were just talking about, that if you study this poem properly, you can use it as the basis to surely get awakening in this very life. And that mm-hmm. seems to be the first use of that expression. And so study was sort of formulated as a kind of natural basis for practice.
Mm-hmm.
And you see in Lady's articulation of what practice is, that it's profoundly scholastic, one might even say, in, mm-hmm. in terms, you know, unlike the way I think often, at least kind of regular people with an interest in meditation, say here in the West, envision it, you know, if you have that kind of interest, you go and you buy a book like How to Meditate or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's really about the technique of meditation. And maybe there's a little theory in it, but it's really right. about the technique. You'd be at a loss if you really sought such a text by Lady. In fact, what you find is when you even read a book that's about meditation, like he has a book called The Anapanasati about breath meditation,
mm-hmm.
it you read it and you're like, well, this just sounds like a philosophical textbook on like the kind of metaphysical mechanics of meditation, not how you actually meditate.
Yeah.
But those cannot be separated so easily in Lady's view, because in a sense, your knowledge of the practice is, to a significant degree, your understanding of its kind of metaphysical underpinnings and its sort of metaphysical formulation and
uh-huh.
and what have you. So there was a very organic kind of sort of connection between the two that allows for one to lead directly to the other.
Mm-hmm. Right. Kind of reminds me of George Dreyfus's argument about the importance of having like a coherent soteriology in order to sort of motivate people towards practice. But anyway,
well, you know, you're right. There's a kind of a tension sometimes you see crop up, I think, in many different forms of Buddhism, and certainly in Theravada, between the monks who claim you've got to have some serious study before you begin to practice versus those who say, no, you don't need any study at all. You'll just figure it out, and maybe you'll get a little bit as you go along. And Lady definitely fell in the latter camp,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And some of his disciples certainly did as well.
Yeah. Well, one last thing I wanted to address in the chapter on, I mean, there's a lot that we can't cover here due to time, but one thing I did want to talk about is you discuss the way you discuss this sort of difference of between insight meditation as discursive thinking and insight meditation as simple awareness of, for example, tactile sensations or one's breath. I think many people with a familiarity with modern presentations of Buddhist meditation, sort of people who might have read some of the books that, you know, you were just sort of the, you know, Buddhism, the kind of introduction to meditation type of books that you were just referencing.
Right.
People with familiar with those sorts of presentations of Buddhist meditation think of insight meditation as, I think, mainly the latter, just a sort of bare awareness type of stuff. And
right.
And sometimes
right.
as intentionally excluding discursive thinking, or at least consciously or at least avoiding consciously directed discursive thinking.
Right.
Here you sort of, correct me if I'm wrong, but you suggest that Letty's approach was actually sort of a combining of the two.
I think that would be fair to say. I mean, in the sense that I think actually a number of scholars lately have been beginning to push back against a kind of a sense of mindfulness is to simply bear attention. Of course, that's a profoundly influential term, really coined by Nyanaponika Thera, you know, in his book, The Heart of Buddhist Meditation in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
But it sort of leads to this, let's say, Jon Kabat-Zinn kind of senses of mindfulness as a kind of non-judgmental, non-discursive, just sort of pure awareness
mm-hmm.
without any kind of content, as you say. But, you know, I think scholars are recognizing that when you begin to look at what the definitions are of sati, of mindfulness, in say, the early Buddhist texts and in later commentarial literature, and then you also look at how it's understood to function, of course, sati or smriti is related to the idea of memory, and there seems to be a sense in which it incorporates a kind of knowledge that's in some sense not discursive, but a kind of, well, a kind of function of memory that's present in that moment of awareness. Bhikkhu Bodhi has a very good article and issue last year of contemporary Buddhism about this. Rupert Gethin's done some work on this as well. And in fact, I think they're trying to push back towards a richer sense of what mindfulness was in earlier literature that I think Lady shares.
I see.
That for him, the idea that you would just go in and just be kind of blankly aware of everything going on around you, mm-hmm. maybe blank isn't a very fair term, but let's say self-consciously non-elaborative and non-discursive, would be kind of fruitless unless you have some kind of deep-seated sense of these operative dharmic categories that could guide your thinking and, mm-hmm. and bring about that insight.
Yeah.
So there is a kind of, you're right, there's a kind of combination in the sense that it's not that he necessarily wants people to be sitting around going, oh yeah, I totally see the atomic structure of this plant, you know, in this very discursive way.
Yeah.
But at the same time, he would want them to have that kind of sense of the ceaseless impermanence of the atomic structure in all things at a yeah. deep-seated level that allows it to come through in your observation.
So we've taken a lot of your time, but as a final question, I wanted to ask you if there's something you're working on at the moment.
Sure. Oh, yes. I mean, it never stops, right?
Yeah.
And I'm working on a couple of things, but I am putting a lot of emphasis on a project that actually, the conclusion to the book we've been talking about carries forward in just a very brief way, the story of mindfulness into the West with mm-hmm. people like Dak Kornfield and Sharon Salzberg and Joseph
sure.
Goldstein, but then also some of the developments that have been taking place in Burma since Lady's time up to the present day.
Mm.
And so then this current project I'm working on, which is tentatively titled A Great Awakening, looks at how meditation is transforming in the contemporary period, running parallel, essentially, an analysis between what's going on in Burma these mm-hmm. days versus what's going on in the West.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, these things are interacting with one another.
Yeah.
So it's sort of observing how figures travel back and forth in these global flows and what this means for secularity. Mm-hmm. And for what it means that there's been a kind of neurophysicalist turn towards, you know, brain scans and what Willoughby Britton, neuroscience researcher at Brown University, calls the blobology effect. You know, this kind of idea about what are these blobs in the brain? Is that the truth about what meditation really does? So I'm looking at all of this, essentially these modern transformations in both East and West Burma and the States in the modern period. It really builds upon this book.
Yeah.
And that's the sort of main project I have a focus on right now.
All right. Yeah, and I should mention for listeners that we didn't have time to cover this, but as you mentioned, in the conclusion, you give a very nice and clear synopsis of some of the lineages that came out of Ledi Sayadaw and also some of the parallel Burmese lineages that that had sort of very little or no contact with Ledi Sayadaw, but many of these are important for, as you mentioned, the development of sort of insight meditation in the West. So you'll have to get the book and read that. Anyway, the listeners, that is not, I'm sure you own a copy. Well, thank you very much for speaking with me today. And thank you to our listeners for tuning in. And that's it for today's New Book in Buddhist Studies. See you next time.